I am talking about the emergency mental health service during the war, and maybe you can fill in some more detail about that. So your place in the setup and so on, and how it all came about, and how, whether you were directed there by the Ministry of Labour, or you know how it was all handled.
Well, it was Dame Evelyn Fox's vision, really. In the year before war broke out, she was so convinced there was going to be a war, and she always said that mental health would be the first casualty. And she was very anxious that should some effort should be made to develop the services, which would be more needed than ever.
Yeah.
And so PSWs were approached, I think through the APSW, if they would volunteer to work during the war in whatever way they required, because of mental health.
Yeah.
And I think most of us did volunteer, I certainly did. Although we were very vague as to what would be required.
You were approached before the war, about?
Yes, a year before.
1938, they asked you, would you volunteer?
Yes, we would volunteer to do something for the Mental Health Corps. And we had to say that we'd be ready to do anything. Yeah. And I thought to myself, I know I shall be posted as a nurse to a mental hospital, which would terrify me. We were heavily involved with work at the clinic. I was then at the Wilsdon Child Guidance Clinic, where we had a group of students from the Institute of Education, and as well as our own cases and various other teaching things that we were doing there, William Patterson Brown and I. And so we were very worried about the question of whether, in fact, war was coming, the clinic would have to close, how we would wind up, what we would do. But we didn't get a chance to do any elaborate winding up. The clinic was closed with a week's notice. And William was called off into the Air Force, disappeared. And so I was left with the heart-rending business of telling the patients that we had to go, we couldn't be there. And the students saying goodbye to them and so on.
Yes.
And almost immediately, I think I had only a few days, I got a letter from the Ministry of Health asking if I would conduct a party of evacuees and act as welfare officer for the evacuees in Northampton, giving me a date to go. And I had hardly time to make any preparations and no time to book a room or anything. But the old CAMW used to run training courses for staff who were going to be mental deficient, the Central Association for Mental Welfare, Dame Evelyn Fox's outfit. And they ran courses for workers who were going to work with then mental defectives under the Act. And she had a trainee in Northampton who trained with her. And she wrote to this trainee and said, she will find a bed for you. So I went off with about 800 evacuees up to Northampton. And we were met by the billeting officers who had arranged accommodation for them. I could do nothing except watch them go at that point. And I was then going to go, by this time it was about 7 o'clock in the evening, and I was going to start looking for a room, going round to my contact. I was afraid she'd have left her office. And they told me that there was an SOS, would I go out to a girl's home where there had been a disturbance.
Yes.
And there was trouble. Have I told you this before? Perhaps I have. Anyway, this is the beginning of it.
Yes.
So I had to go out, and this was the Northamptonshire School for Maladjusted Girls, or some such title, a residential approved school, which was run by a PSW.
Yeah.
And they'd had a riot, and the girls were on the roof, throwing down tiles and so on, and refusing to come down. And strange though it seemed, it turned out a very lucky introduction for me.
Yes.
Because I found out that a psychiatrist visited the home and that the girls were fond of him.
Yes.
So I asked if I could ring up the psychiatrist and ask his advice and help. He was the medical director of the local hospital.
Yes.
And he came round and was a delightful person and did all the right things. The girls were soon down and talking to him, and I was introduced. Though eventually we had to close the home. But this made an unorthodox introduction, and with him afterwards I started a child guidance clinic in Northampton. But anyway, then after that was over, I then went back to the station and couldn't contact my couldn't make my contact. So I had to ask a railway porter to direct me, and I went to a very low-class pub for the night. Mm. And then the mental efficiency worker the next day said that Northampton was overcrowded, there weren't any rooms and so on, so I had a lot of problem. However, I was then put under the Director of Education.
No rooms for you or no rooms for the children?
No, all the children were billeted, that had gone smoothly.
Yes.
Though a lot of them were on my doorstep the next day. But I was given a book room at the local authority education office. Mm. And the Director of Education, who was Mr. Perrin, who was a remarkable man, he accepted, you know, this strange thing that there I was in this room, surrounded by books which teachers came in to look at and choose, and no telephone. Yeah. And as I was constantly wanted on the telephone, I had to walk down a passage and go into the accounts room and telephone. They soon gave me a telephone, too much nuisance. And then I got another room and so on. But I found from the beginning a full-time job in helping the evacuees to settle down and the billet holders to cope with these yes. strange London creatures.
Yes.
And the staff, school teachers who'd come with the children and who did a half day at the school, they had a lot of problems too, yes. because it was half day London children and half day Northampton children. It turn about week by week, one had the morning, the other the afternoon. And you could imagine the London teachers hid the chalk and the Northampton teachers came and couldn't find the chalk and so on. And we had to have a lot of discussions and meetings and trying to help the Northampton people to understand the London children and the London children to understand a different life and particularly trips into the countryside where they left gates open and so on and so forth. And they, so there we were quite busy straight away, and almost immediately, well, finally we put up a dozen, but there were protests. Some children were impossible. They were so disturbed they couldn't be billeted anywhere. And so we had speedily to open a hostel for the yes. two difficult children. We put boys and girls together. We had a London psychologist yes. in charge at first, but she didn't last long. And then gradually there were other problems came up, such as the bedwetters, the chronic bedwetters. We had to start a hostel for them. Mm. And then skin cases, impetigo and scabies particularly. We couldn't billet them until they were cleared.
Yes.
And we had a very successful unit with remarkable results for the scabies clearing up, with a wonderful nurse in charge and good modern methods. And head knits we didn't take into residence for, we did that as outpatients. But we all had to work very closely together. The billeting officers were the education officers from the... And they were men who knew the neighbourhood in and out, and many of them very wise and good people to work with. And I used them a lot with some of my families. And then the health visitors, we worked very closely with them. And they again were very helpful local people. And the school clinic, they had a school clinic every morning between 9 and 10, which of course I encouraged all my mothers, billet mothers, to take the children any sign, anything they wanted help with. Mm. And then the doctor attended once a week
yes.
and could refer through to him. Mm. So we worked very closely with them, and the health visitors would come to these clinics too. And I've often thought it's something that could well be repeated under the health service,
yes.
Where a nurse could deal with the minor things very successfully.
Did you anticipate all these problems with the children, or was it all a great surprise to you when you found out about enuresis?
Enuresis, no, because I'd made a study of enuresis. I'd done research before I joined the clinic staff, so I was particularly interested in that. But the scabies and impetigo, I'd never seen scabies before, and I had to learn to detect it. And nits I'd never seen before. Impetigo I had come across one way and another. But no, they were mostly new things and new people to work with and a new setup altogether, because I'd never worked for a local authority before.
Yes.
And another thing that I hadn't foreseen was the starting of these hostels,
yes.
particularly as I was given so much responsibility. I would go and choose a house, and then the Director of Education would come with me to approve, and I was given a free hand in buying the equipment.
Gotcha.
I used to go to auctions and buy chairs for 5 shillings and all sorts of things. It was really great fun. And some of my volunteers, mothers were able to be evacuated with their children if they would volunteer for work. And I had some very good people amongst those. One of them became the resident head of the Enuresis Hostel with her daughter there.
Did you choose the way you were going to work? Or were there directives from the Ministry of Health? Or did you just get on and do the job as best you could?
Yes, as best I could. No directives at all. I really could have done anything, it seemed to me.
Yes.
And the ministry was, I thought, really amazingly indulgent that what I asked for, I got. For instance, when I found some of the children with severe problems, then I needed a psychological test, I said to the ministry, I must have a psychologist to help.
Yes.
And I suggest you send one from London one day a week. We could fully employ them.
Yes.
And they did. I had a first-class psychologist.
Yes.
And then also I said that I must have a consultant psychiatrist. And they allowed me to use this friendly, I don't know what terms they did with him.
Yes.
But it was improvisation, really, and one could do what one wanted. Well, and then the hostels multiplied until there were 13 in the end. First for the maladjusted children, enuresis, scabies. Then we were asked to take expectant mothers from London in the last month of pregnancy so that they could have their children in the country. A coachload came up every Friday and came to the clinic where the midwives and health visitors, the doctor and I were all there, and they coped with the medical side as to which were fit for billets and what kind of billets.
Yes.
And I coped with the social side as far as I could so that we could put them appropriately. Most of them were billeted individually. But we soon found we had to have a hostel for the problem cases of one kind or another. Then we had to have another hostel for mothers and babies who, when they were discharged from hospital, needed care before they could be settled and know where to go to. Then we were asked to take on heart cases, boys who were discharged from a school for physically handicapped, who needed special care in a special hostel. And another hostel for the adult blind, and a Jewish hostel for children who had to have kosher diet. That's from Willesden. And I had problems with that because they had a Jewish rabbi in charge, resident in the hostel, who's started making it a Zionist center and having collected boxes for Zionism and so on.
Yes.
And I said that was not what we were there to support.
Yes.
So that was quite a problem. Well, I couldn't have done this by any means if I hadn't had a splendid deputy who was a trained social worker.
Yes.
And she came and worked with me, and when in 42 I was asked to go south to the...
Sorry, when you say she was a trained social worker, do you mean she had a social science certificate or that she was a PSW?
Not a PSW, no, she had a social science certificate.
Yes.
I think Nottingham.
What was then called a... Social,
yes, that was it.
Yes.
Quite right, she was then called a trained social worker.
Yes.
She was a splendid person. I had the utmost confidence in handing over to her. Well, then I say we were going along with these hostels and I had this Mary Stewart helping me. When Dunkirk, as I've already mentioned, the soldiers mostly collapsed on our platforms and we had arranged to billet them. And the army arranged soup kitchens at the end of every street so that the billet holders wouldn't be bothered by having to feed these men.
Yes.
And the soup kitchens were never used.
Really?
The billet holders just took them in.
Yes.
In a wonderful way. And most of them, within a few days of food and sleep, recovered and were ready to discuss going home or whatever.
Yes.
But some of them weren't.
Yes.
And some of them were a problem and had nowhere to go or didn't want to go home or there were problems and so on. And those I found myself having to deal with daily, you see.
Yes.
And this I reported to the ministry and it was happening up and down the country. The other regional representatives were finding this too. And it was then that the ministry, with great imagination, founded this aftercare of psychiatric casualties.
Yes.
And we were each given a region. 12 regions. Well then, when I came to Tunbridge Wells, again, I had really no instructions. I had a letter to the local, each of the local mental hospitals, asking them to give me facilities, and to say that I was to be allowed to visit each of the service casualties in the hospitals and to see their medical papers. And I had no office and no equipment. I used to work in the public library until I managed to get a room, and no staff. But I was very lucky. I was able to find a room in the Conservative Association office, which was a charming office on the Green in Tunbridge Wells, and very soon got two voluntary typists. One took shorthand as well, who felt it was their war work to come, and we gradually expanded. And then I reported every month to the ministry what cases I'd seen and what I'd done and so on, and they authorised further staff, yes, until we were six or seven, I think, on the staff, yeah. Kenneth Brill being one of them.
Yeah.
So, and there, I personally visited each of our hospitals, the four in the region, which took psychiatric cases from the forces, and each week went through the case records of the people there and saw the patients, mm-hmm, and discussed with them how they saw going home, what they're going to do next. And I wrote up that report, which was sent up to the ministry, mm-hmm, one copy, and the other copy went to my office, and we sent somebody within the first week of their return home to visit,
yeah,
them. If it was in our area, it was one of our staff. If it was in a, they were going to a county outside our area, I wrote to my opposite number's regional representative and gave them the full particulars, mm, so that they could visit.
Mm.
And we kept case records of all these patients, mm, which was stored at the NAMH,
yes,
over 30,000 by the end of the war, and very bulky papers. And of course, they became a different problem, how to store them, and they were moved down to the country, to Parnham, where we had the place. But a lack of Parnham, which was the home that we had for what they used to call mentally frail old ladies, but
yes,
disturbed elderly women.
Yes.
And sadly, after I'd left, they were thrown out,
yes,
which was a great opportunity for somebody's research.
Yes,
so, yes now.
Well, firstly, I suppose really a personal thing.
Mm.
One of the things that strikes me hearing you say all that, and again, Claire Winnicott told a similar tale about Oxfordshire, or questions in the mind, anyway, that runs through the mind is, so to what extent did the mental health course prepare you for working in that context? Because it was geared either to clinics or hospitals, wasn't it?
Yes.
And here you were working in a community, having to ad lib and improvise, so to speak.
Yes.
Working in the community. And I wondered whether any of the knowledge from the mental health course was transferable in a sense, or whether you were just, it was from outside the course and you were working on your wits.
I think a great deal did come from the course, particularly this idea of never feeling alone, that you were part of a team.
Yes.
I think that was the great lesson of the course, and to train you to work as a member of the team. And it was the strength of the regional representatives that they had been trained as members of the team and could collect a team round them.
Yes.
I think that also experience at the clinic, working with all sorts and conditions of people,
yes,
making contact and entering into their family lives with them, did give us experience. And it was remarkable that each of the 12 regions had a PSW,
yes,
put in charge. I mean,
yes,
they could have chosen an almoner, probation officer,
yes,
but in fact it was a PSW, and it seemed to me that that was appropriate.
Yes, there was a lot of... it was sort of all very creative, wasn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it pushed back the boundaries of social work knowledge.
Yes,
in that experience. Mm. Yeah.
That was what was so stimulating and enabled us to carry really tremendous burdens.
Yes. Was that the first time PSWs had, worked in the community in that way, and B, sort of had to relate their professional knowledge to translate it into professional Understanding of professional relationships as opposed to relationships with clients. Saying to the Ministry of Health, I must have a psychologist once a week, I can employ them.
Yes. But I think to a certain extent, the fact that the early clinics were voluntary had given us introduction to that world. Because we had to raise our money. To begin with, the Commonwealth Fund supported the Canterbury Clinic, but with a reducing income. And so that we were having to say, now, how can we approach the local authority? How can we interest them?
Yes.
What are the people of the local authority we must get in contact with?
Yes.
How can we put a case to them that they can put before their council?
Yes.
That really opened my eyes to the workings of local authorities and the attempts of getting at people beyond your own particular field. We had to do it in order to survive.
Yes. Who were you answerable to in the local authority?
It was a voluntary... The Canterbury one was it was
when
council.
During the war, who was the body you were answerable to then?
The Director of Education in Northampton was the local boss.
Yes.
I asked about my office, I demanded a telephone and so on and so forth, and about the hostels.
Yes.
But anything such as the consultant psychiatrist, I just wrote to the Ministry of Health and told him I was doing it.
Were they ad hoc administrative arrangements then with each local authority? Because Claire Winnicott was saying she was answerable to the clerk of the council. Did that depend on where you worked?
I suppose so.
Did you have meetings together to talk about common problems?
The regional representatives? Yes, we did. Dame Evelyn was very keen to do that, and at first we met fairly seldom, and then we agreed to meet, I think, once a month. And we had a residential weekend.
Yes.
But are you unhappy there? Would you like to move out of the glare? Because you've got glasses.
Yes, I have that. I mean...
Further back one, you wouldn't have it in your eyes.
I'm okay.
You're right, good.
If I get uncomfortable.
Yes.
Yes, you were talking about the meetings and...
So. Yes, and these meetings usually were very much on the case problem side, because we had a lot of problems about how far you would go with the case and how much intensive work you could do, and you'd have to neglect the others. And if you took on unqualified staff, what you could let them do and how you could teach them and so on and so forth. We had a lot of practical problems of that kind.
Yes.
And I remember Goldberg was asked to collect. They were very anxious to know how our cases were faring, and we were asked, each of us asked, to present a description of six cases we considered successful and six cases we considered failures.
Yes. Yes.
I dare say you've seen it. And Goldberg developed these and put them together and tried to get guiding lines out of what had happened. And this was discussed at the conferences continually.
Yes.
That sort of thing.
Did you also have meetings with the Ministry of Health?
Yes.
Geraldine.
Yes. I did those personally when I could. I came up to London and put forward my claims about things.
Yes.
We'd had, the most absurd discussions. For instance, when should we wear a uniform? Because it was said that you couldn't have any discipline or indeed contact with service personnel unless you were an officer or had some, and all the psychiatrists went into uniform, and it was too funny to call and see an old psychiatrist doddering along dressed as a colonel going into the wards.
Yes.
And at one time it was suggested that we would be better off wearing uniform.
Yes.
We were all against that because we went in as persons, one of the family, so to speak.
I noticed in the appendix to the Curtis Committee that John Bowlby is referred to as Lieutenant Colonel John Bowlby.
Yes, really a strange world.
Yes.
And we did have various doctors, would sometimes say they didn't want us to see the medical notes, but we had our letters from the ministry.
Yes.
And in fact, there was no real difficulty over that, and nor of seeing the patients.
Was your Director of Education always sort of helpful and cooperative, or did you have battles or think about strategies about how you were going to cope?
No, he was really rather a remarkable man. I think, a very simple background,
yeah.
And thrilled with his position and with the wartime stimulus that had given really to his work, with all these evacuees coming in,
mm.
and that he was having contacts and attending conferences and things that he never had before. Northampton is a very prosperous town, and it had the curious feature that its men were not called up in the war because they were bootmakers,
yeah.
and they made boots for the Americans as well as the English.
Yeah.
And so it was a very unusual town,
yeah.
With prosperous families and prosperous children, and then there was this invasion of all these London children. And he was a very practical man, and he enjoyed the situation. I remember going to him one morning early on when he said, you know, our chief trouble now is with the waterworks, the sewage and so on.
Mm.
Can you imagine, we've got all these thousand extra children, imagine how many plugs are pulled in the morning?
Yes.
He was that sort of man.
Yes. Yes.
But he was great fun. We enjoyed each other, I think, really. He got I think it was the MBE.
Yes.
And enormous pleasure and excitement,
yes.
and really I think he deserved it.
That's very interesting, you telling me just that little story there, you know, because Rosemary Braithwaite surprised me by asking me, did I know what determined which areas should receive evacuees and how many they should receive? And I said, you know, I made various guesses which were all wrong, and it turned out it was the sewage at each area.
Well,
Somerset had more than Devon because they had superior sewage rates.
Well, it's a very practical point, you see, and it never had occurred to me.
Yes.
But the. But certainly Northampton was a good choice. It was free from bombing,
yes.
and the children were fed at a very high level. I think I told of a child saying to me, in Northampton we have Sunday dinner every day.
Yes.
And that really occurred, and a lot of the children you could see putting on weight and,
yes.
and really flourishing.
Did you pick up work from other departments of the local authority that were responsible for children? You know, nothing to do with evacuee children, but boarded out children, things like that. Did your work grow?
Well, I had to take on the registered mental defective children,
yes.
because this colleague who was supposed to find a room
yes.
for me had a mental breakdown,
yes.
and had to go into hospital, and there was no replacement.
Yes.
So I had to take on her families with my
yes.
staff and work with them. And then through knowing the teachers in the school, I was
yes.
quite often asked about this and that, and that was why I started the Child Guidance Clinic. I said we must
yes.
have a clinic open to all, not just for the evacuees.
Yes.
And there was a very cooperative almoner at the hospital there. We had held the clinic in the hospital.
Yes.
And she gave all the facilities and helped with clerical help and so on. It really was extremely lucky.
Did you begin to, by the end of the war, I know it was precipitated by the tragedy with the O'Neill boys and so on, but there was this sort of pressure for aid inquiry into care of children who were deprived of a normal human life, wasn't there? And,
yes.
I know Claire Winnicott, for example, you know, did say to me, well, she kept on picking up so many funny little bits and pieces of work that in the end she actually did say one day, we could just have a department here for children.
Yes.
Never mind the evacuee children.
Yes.
Well,
we did, as I say, we started this
yes.
child guidance clinic, which still goes on,
yes.
and the Hospital for Mentally Adjusted Children still goes on.
Yes. Were you...
Wait a minute, there's just something else was just floated in my mind at the moment then about the other things. What could that be? Well, never mind, go on, it'll come back.
Your interest really sort of went more towards the aftercare of the adults. Am I right in thinking that as you took on this extra work?
Yes.
And your sort of post-war career
yes.
sort of
yes.
in that direction.
Yes.
Yes.
Suddenly thought I was going to say. You were saying about the question of care of children away from their own homes, and of course that concerned me very much about the evacuees, for instance the enuretics, how much it was emotional stress and so on. But also another very interesting thing was that we had evacuated to Northampton, the Wilsdon Children's Homes.
Yes.
And these were large formal homes with children dressed very much the same uniform. Mm. And the little boys wore boots, which astounded the Northampton children.
Yes.
Boot-making place, they didn't know boots. And I had tremendous talks with the Wilsdon staff. They sent visiting staff who came down and gave the children pocket money. And so I had great talks with them. And I went up and interviewed the Wilsdon people to try to get them made more like ordinary children.
Yes.
And I remember their director of education saying, well, you can always tell a Wilsdon child they're better dressed than the others.
Yes.
And I said, I don't want to tell a Wilsdon child. I want them to be the same as the others. Take them out of those boots.
Yes.
And I think we were able to do something of breaking down these very high material standards and letting the children be ordinary children, as they were billeted about.
Yes. The thought that just came into my mind then was how fantastic it is that sort of on the one hand, say you get someone like Claire Winnicott, whose main interest centered on these children and went on afterward to concentrate on them, all that side, and someone like yourself, whose main interest focused on these adult psychiatric casualties, and after the war developed all that side, all that went with the concerns.
Well, it's amazing. It happened to me, so to speak.
Yes, but such enormous developments coming from people who had to do a mental health course and happened to get focusing on these interests during the war. It's like the war as a forcing ground.
Yes.
These things.
One of the things which also affected my interest, though still was in children, but which expanded my horizon, was the international work.
Yes.
I don't know if I've mentioned that to you, that I 8 days after the end of the war went out to Switzerland to discuss their offer of convalescence for children who'd suffered from bombing. And I made a close association then with the psychiatrist who'd planned all this, Oscar Farrell, and afterwards became the British representative for his international team for sending. And this brought me back into interest of children and how best to help them, the ones who'd been through severe war experiences, as well as orphans and ones who lived under pressures of different kinds.
Well, can we move on to the end of the war then, and when you decided to join NA? I mean, that was a deliberate career choice, was it, or was that?
No, it happened to me. There I was working, you see, for the Ministry of Health until when the Section 28 came into force, they wound up and said, that's the end of it. And Dame Evelyn immediately said to me, well, then you'll come and work in the London, because we're...
Sorry, can I interrupt? Can you say that a little more elaborately? Because from the point of view of my continuity,
that's
right.
Well, in 1942, I'd been appointed to the aftercare scheme, and at the end of the war, the Act came to force 48.
Yes.
We went on working until 48, and then the ministry wrote, I understand, to all the local authorities saying, now it's your responsibility, you go ahead and do this, we've done all we can.
Yes.
And I think they were advised or encouraged to help to take on the staff that they had.
Yes.
And I had these four counties, and Kent and East Sussex asked me to stay on, and Surrey and West Sussex went their own way.
Yes.
And but this didn't take up my whole time, so that I had, I think, 3 days a week in Tunbridge Wells and 2 days a week on the staff in London. And there they still had Miss Hayshaw, who was running the aftercare, or the aftercare psychiatric patients became the community care section of the NAMH.
Yes.
And she was running that, and then she decided, I came up to help her. We did part time there, particularly on the training side of outsiders. And then she decided to go to Canada.
Yes.
And so Dame Evelyn said, well, you're taking over. I mean, that was just that. And I said, well, temporarily, till I see what I'm going to do.
Yes.
And at that time, I applied for a search job, the only job I've ever applied for, and the only one I've ever been refused, with the Children's Bureau.
Yes.
No, not the Children's Bureau, the one before the... Oh, the thing in Coram Fields. I did lectures there. It was called the Child Research or something. It was the predecessor of the Children's Bureau. And they were going to do research there in child development, which would have interested me. But I was glad in the end that I didn't take that on, because the NEMH work developed so much. Yes. Because then I became interested on the training side, which I'd already had to be concerned with for my ad hoc teams, and particularly the training of health visitors. And there I had remarkable good fortune in meeting the senior health visitor of LCC. Can't remember her name at the moment, who enthusiastically took up the training of health visitors by psychiatric social workers. Mm. And so I did for her a course of 20 weekly lectures with health visitors and repeated sections of that several times, and had several residential conferences with health visitors. And then the Royal Society of Health took me on as the organizer of their social work sections of their annual conferences, and that brought me into contact with other people in other spheres.
Had you got yourself by that time then committed to the training demands and problems of the mental welfare officers in the newly created local authority health departments, their mental health services? But didn't the NMH organise a lot of short courses?
Yes, we did.
Was that your...
Yes, that was part of it too. And I immediately saw how much wider training they needed, and that led me on really to my young husband thoughts.
Yes. Does that have its roots from the war, your war experience, or...?
Yes, from the war experience. Because there were all sorts of people that I worked with for the first time. The education officers, who were the billeting officers, whom I worked with very closely. And their experience seemed to me so valuable, and yet so uncoordinated.
Yeah.
And so much more could have been got out of their experience and given to them.
Yeah.
They're dealing with truants and so on and so forth. And they were splendid men, they really were. And then the mental welfare officers, and I was involved in two or three cases of certifying people and working with them and so on. And there again, there seemed to be such opportunity for working with the patients and with the families, and for getting people to go peacefully to hospital instead of having police and whatnots. And they were ready to learn that.
Yes.
Mm. So that interested me, in this possibility of training and more training, and also the health visitor side.
Yes. And did anybody respond wholeheartedly to that NEMH initiative, or did you have uphill fights in some areas?
We had enormous difficulty in getting any financial support for any courses.
Yes.
Some were prepared to let people come to a free course, but we couldn't run them free. We had to.
Yes.
We were a voluntary body. That was a great problem. And then, problems of whether the local authority would pay or the ministry would subsidize and so on. There's a lot we had to learn there. But then followed on, the service on these various committees and councils.
Yes.
And that encouraged my training interests and gave me a chance of expressing some of them, both the Council for Training in Social Work and its predecessor, and the Institute.
Yes.
And then the Family Welfare Association also. I was on their council for a long time, and family service units, all concerned with training.
Yes.
They all had a burning interest.
Yes. Did you, that's the other thing, did you lobby the Ministry of Health about the training needs of these mental welfare officer chaps?
To this extent that we asked for grants for running the courses and training and put forward cases of their need for training.
Did they give you grants?
I'm not very well up on that side, but we certainly did run them. We must have had some grants, I think.
Yes.
I think we did get support. Our efforts with the police failed. Somebody else that we... Who else did we... to remember those courses. Who were they? The Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children.
Yes.
We tried to do some courses with them. And the moral welfare workers.
Yes.
We tried to expand their experience in mental health work.
At that time, the NAMH saw itself partly as a provider of services, partly as a sponsor of training courses.
Yes.
And partly as a lobbyist for reform of mental health.
Yes, that was Dame Evelyn's strong line. She had high-powered friends, and she was a very strong advocate, full of Irish fire and enthusiasm, and a great orator.
Yes.
She really did marvels, I think.
Yes. How did was that an NAMH initiative that led to the Pearcey Commission? Or I know I wouldn't have been alone, but I mean, was there a build-up of pressure, that's all.
I think there certainly was. And at one time, the no bill came before Parliament without their discussing it with Dame Evelyn first. Mr. Justice Scott was a great friend of hers, and they used to draw up the legal side together. Yeah. And then she had all sorts of friends at court who consulted her. And she would sit up all night. She would say, that, look at these papers we've got, and you make any comments and give them to me, and then I'll bring them in tomorrow morning. And she'd sit up all night and yeah. She was a terrific worker, a great enthusiast, great personality. And she had to be, because you see, when the three bodies were amalgamated, they were each had pioneer strong women in charge.
Yeah.
And Doris Odlam, who'd done the mental hygiene, she brought in her director and thought her director would run the office. And there had to be a lot of maneuvering.
Yes.
But it was undoubted that Dame Evelyn won the battle and managed to keep Doris Odlam as a faithful adherent, which was a great thing. But we weren't able to win over the, the people who had all the hostels, the Mental Welfare Association.
Yes. Yes.
They had money and we had none, and they didn't see the point of bringing all their capital into the... And they never have joined up.
No.
I mustn't overemphasize the training side of the NAMH. I mean, I think it was more individual interests than the actual council meetings. I don't remember council meetings discussing training.
Yes.
But I would ask if I could take part in this, and was given approval. And I know Dame Evelyn very much approved. But they'd had their vicissitudes because they used to run the mental welfare training for workers for mental defectives, a one-year training. And then Nellie Dean, I don't know if you've been interested to interview her, she ran that course devotedly for years and years and made it a very useful course for the people who were going to work at the centres, the handicapped people's centres. That was... Then that was wound up. Then we gave fellowships to psychologists, and that was finally wound up. And we did try to have joint training with paediatricians, and that never came off the ground.
Yes.
We hoped the child psychiatrists and paediatricians would train together, which I'm sure they ought to, but it never came off the ground.
Mm. When did you first come across Letty Harford then?
Well, when I started in London after the end of the war, when I came up into the social services department, questions there arose about what to do with certain cases and how to get things moving. And I would always ring up Letty and get this cheerful, friendly answer. And she always knew everybody who was the person to approach. She was indefatigable, she knew everybody. And she was the most generous of her time and knowledge and everything else. Indefatigable, rushing from one meeting to another, and always carrying it off with good spirit, you know, light-hearted. I remember in her retirement party, Eileen Young's husband made the speech and reminded Letty of an occasion, some very important occasion, when they'd gone on a delegation to the Ministry of Health. And when they'd got there, Eileen said to Letty, well, now, you've got the papers, haven't you? Oh, no, said Letty, I thought you had, and burst out laughing. Eileen said she was prepared to weep, but later, and she carried off the interview in a splendid fashion.
Yes, yes.
So she was a great person and went on. You see, she's now 88, 89 or something, and she was serving on the committee of help for Algerian students over here. Until about 2 years ago, I suppose.
Really?
Yes, yes, because I was on the committee too, and she used to come back and spend the night here.
Yes.
But she would come up from Essex,
yes,
to Liverpool Street on an awful journey and travel,
yes,
down. And this,
yes,
was an evening meeting. We didn't get back here for supper till about 9 o'clock. I was always exhausted, but she was up next morning and off to do something else.
Yes.
Making the most of her night in London.
Yes. You were saying that she really collected the material for George Haynes. She was the one who did the
spade work, yes, yes, yes,
work,
yes. She was the social worker. She was really, she did a course, I think, in Liverpool, you know, before there was a qualifying course.
Yes.
She was a pioneer.
Yes, she was telling me
yes
about that.
And she was, I think how I ought to put it was that she was great support and standby to,
yes,
George Haynes, who was the skilled politician and statesman.
Yes.
And she was the one who had the personal contacts, the personal work,
yes,
and spoke about it extremely well.
Yes.
She was well known as a summer up of conferences, and they had an, yes, international social work conference, perhaps, mm-hmm, going on for 5 days. It, mm-hmm, ended with Letty Harford doing a brilliant summary, pleasing,
yes,
everybody. She would always be reckoned on to do that. And her sister, she was devoted to her sister, Honoria Harford, who died recently, who was a pioneer of the Boys and Girls Clubs, a national figure, really, did all sorts. And then after she retired, took on club work for the handicapped and ran summer camps and all sorts of things for the physically handicapped.
Was that the sister who worked at Bernardo's with her and who took a group of children to Australia?
Must have been, because she only...